The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Oh, yeah, I gotta do that again. Good evening. Much better. So, before we begin, please silence your phones. Also, please refrain from taking any pictures and plan to join us upstairs after the event for the book signing. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Naisha Patterson, and I am truly honored to be here this evening to introduce Terry McMillan. It all started shelving books at her local library. This is where Terry McMillan discovered her love for literature. Some of her novels include Waiting to Excel, How Stella Got Her Groove Back, both that were made into motion pictures that did very well at the box office, A Day Late and A Dollar Short, The Interruption of Everything, Getting to Happy, and Disappearing Acts, one of my favorite love stories ever that turned into a made-for-TV movie with Wesley Snipes and Sanaa Lathan. When thinking of Waiting to Exhale, I think of the soundtrack with some of R&B's top songstresses pouring into songs that became anthems of hope and healing. I think of Angela Bassett setting her husband's clothes on fire and all the women in the movie theater screaming, "Yes, girl, yes." Terry's books grab you. Her characters are relatable. You know them. And her stories we've all experienced at some point in our lives. Her novel, I Almost Forgot About You, tells the story of one woman's journey to check herself, to get her life, and become the person that she wants to be while getting a second chance at love. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Terry McMillan to the stage.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. What, are you a relative? You're a relative. Hi, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. I was just told, if you see me go like this, it's because one of my new individual lashes are falling off. I just paid this girl to fill me in, and that's the one that fell off. Anyway, okay, thank you, Philadelphia. And no chili cheese steak for me, or whatever, no. Anyway, so what I'm going to do is this. I'm going to read from this first chapter. Don't follow along with me because you'll be going, because I skip over stuff. Okie dokie. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I can't see you now. Has anyone read the first chapter? Oh, good. Not that many. Okie dokie. I'm trying to stop saying that. I've been around a lot of little kids. Let me see. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. You already know about this story, sort of, so I don't have to. The main character's name is Georgia. Okie dokie. Okay. It's another exciting Friday night, and I'm curled up in bed alone, of course, propped up by a sea of pillows, still in my lab coat, the sash so taut it's suffocating a purple silk dress beneath it, but I don't care. After a grueling day of back-to-back patients, I'm a few minutes away from being comatose, but I'm also hungry, which is why I'm channel surfing and waiting for my pizza to get here. I stop when I come to my favorite standby, Law and Order Criminal Intent, even though I've seen almost all of them, including the reruns. These days, I usually just watch the first 5 or 10 minutes, long enough to see Detective Gorin stride onto the crime scene in his long trench coat, tilt his head to the side while he puts on those rubber gloves, rub the new growth on that beautiful square chin, and bend down to study the victim. It's at this moment, before he utters a word, when I usually pucker up, blow him a kiss, and then change the channel. I've lusted over Detective Gorin and yearned to be held against shoulders like his long before my second marriage bottomed out. Truth be told, over the years, I've fallen in love every Wednesday with Gary Dorden's lips as CSI Warwick Brown. And even though I was no Trekkie, Avery Brooks's deep baritone and sneaky smile made me say yes aloud to the TV. I also let myself be seduced for hours in dark theaters, hypnotized by Benicio del Toro's dreamy eyes, even though he was a criminal, by Denzel's swagger even when he was a slick gangster, Brad Pitt as a sexy young thief, Ken Watanabe as the most sensual samurai I ever wanted to ride on a horse with, and I wanted to be a black geisha and torture him until I finally let him have all of me. I hate to admit it, but if I had the energy, I'd kill to have sex with the first one who walked into my bedroom tonight. I'd let him do anything he wanted to do to me. It's been centuries since I've had sex with a real man, and I'm not even sure I'd remember what to do first should I ever get so lucky again. This is not autobiographical, okay? I make this stuff up. In fact, I think I'd be too uncomfortable, not to mention scared of getting all touchy-feely, and don't even get me started on him seeing me naked. Hell, this is why I sleep with the remote. When I hear the doorbell, I glance over at the broken blue clouds inside the clock of the night on the night table. I've been waiting 40 minutes for this pizza, which means they're going to owe me for a free one. I roll off the bed on my side, even though the other side has been empty for years. I walk over to the door and yell, "Be right there!" Then I grab my wallet out of my purse and beeline it to the front door because I'm starving. That is so not true. I'm just a little hungry. I'm trying to stop lying to myself about little things, but I'm still working on the big ones. I open the door, and standing there sweating is a young black kid who can't be more than 18. His head looks like a small globe of shiny black twists that I know are baby dreadlocks. His cheeks are full of brand new zits. His name tag says free. "I'm so sorry for the delay, ma'am. There was an accident at the bottom of the hill, and I couldn't get up here, so this one's on the house." He looks so sad, and I'm wondering if the price of this pizza is going to be deducted from his little paycheck, but I dare not ask. "I don't mind paying for it," I say. "It wasn't your fault there was an accident." I take the pizza from him and set it on the metal stairwell. "That's real thoughtful of you, but I'm just glad this is my last delivery for the night," he says, leaning to one side as if he's pretending not to look behind me, but of course he is. "This is a real nice crib you got here. I ain't never seen no yellow floors before. It's downright wicked." "Thanks," I say, and hand him a 20. He looks as if he's in shock. "Like I said, man, the pizza's on the house, and I got some drink coupons you can have, too," he says, pulling them out of his red shirt pocket. "It's a tip," I say. "Is your real name Free?" "Yes, ma'am." "How do you feel about it?" "I dig it. I get asked all the time about it." "So how old are you, Free?" "I'm 18. He's still staring at the 20, but then quickly shoves it inside the back pocket of his jeans in case I come to my senses and change my mind. "Are you in college?" I'm hoping he says yes and that he's taking English, so one day soon he'll stop saying ain't. "Almost. That's why I'm working. You really giving me this whole 20? I nod. "Do you know what you want to major in?" "Mechanical engineering," he says with certainty. "That's great. Your husband rich?" "What makes you think I'd have to have a husband to be rich? Everybody live up in these hills, is even them two dykes that live next door, and they marry." "Those dykes aren't just my neighbors. They're also my friends, and they're lesbians." "All right, my bad," he says, flinging his arms up like don't shoot. "I didn't mean no harm. I know anyway I'm divorced, and I'm not rich, but I also don't struggle." "You cleaned him out then, huh?" "No." Then he gives me the once over. "You some kind of doctor?" I look down at my lab coat. "Yes, I'm an optometrist." "Which one is that?" "I help people see clearly," I say, so as not to complicate it. "Who helps you?" He asked with a smile which throws me off completely. What a loaded question to ask a woman old enough to be his grandmother. Just fooling with you, Dr. Young. No disrespect intended. None taken, free. Who helps me see what? She's thinking. Cool, well, look, I got to dash and get this car back to my cousin, but major thanks for the mega tip. And I have to say, it's nice somebody black gave it to me. Most of the white folks up here ain't big on tipping except for them lesbians. What he just said was a little on the racist and sexist side, but I know he meant well. He runs down the sidewalk and jumps into that raggedy car of his, removes the pizza sign displayed on top, and disappears down the hill. I lean against the door frame watching him go. I really should have praised him for working to pay for college. And if he hadn't been in such a hurry, I would have loved to tell him that he might find his calling in college and he might not. But I'd also tell him to search until he did. Otherwise, he could end up doing something he just happened to be good at, something respectable that might guarantee him a nice income, but one day when he's older, like, say, 53, soon to be 54, when his kids have grown up and he's twice divorced and bored with his profession and his life and the thought of trying to change it all or even where he lives scares the hell out of him because it feels like it's too late, I tell him to please figure out a way to do it anyway, since I'm an excellent example of what can happen when you don't. I turn off the porch light and close the door, and I can't believe all of this is flooding in. I walk across these cool yellow concrete floors and sit on these cool metal stairs and look out at that light jutting up through those navy blue waves in the cool black bottom pool, and I look up a flight where both of my daughters used to sleep, and I look down to where the library and the guest room are, and I sit here and eat this entire cheese and tomato pizza. I am full of regret. I'm late because there's an accident on the freeway. And when I get to work, I push past the tall row of windows, and Marina, our 6-foot Japanese receptionist, waves at me. This is San Francisco. She's on the phone sitting behind a long maple counter. In the 4 years she's worked here, she's worn black every single day, including on her fingernails. From here, you can only see her shoulders. She waves and gives me a slow thumbs up that all is fine. Not that I was worried. So, I say when I walk in, what's to Marina? What's the verdict? You've only missed one appointment, and I rescheduled. Thank you much. Is someone in my chair? I ask without looking over the schedule. A newbie. And not to sound corny, but she really is black and beautiful. First name Cleo, last name is Strawberry. How cool is that? We must thank our florist. Cleo just wants new contacts, and Miss Kwan, never mind. You need a tall Pete since you're so late. It won't help, but thanks, Marina. She hands me my appointment list in the patient's folder. Strawberry. I head to my office, grab a clean lab coat from the closet, slip it over my boring blue dress, and sanitize my hands. I read over her chart quickly and head two doors down. I tap lightly on the door. When I hear an energetic voice say, "All is clear," I feel better already. Marina was right. She looks like a black princess, probably in her mid-20s. She closes the Dwell magazine in her lap like a child who's been caught reading something illicit. She reaches over to set it on the instrument table, but knows that's wrong, so I hold my hand out along with a smile and take it. She looks up at me and smiles back. "Good morning, Miss Strawberry. I'm Dr. Young, and I'm so sorry I'm late." "Good morning to you as well. I was probably right in front of you because I just got here about 10 minutes ago, so no need to apologize, Dr. Young. I just hope no one was seriously injured." "I hope not, too." "So, your last name is Strawberry. That's not a very common name." "No, it isn't. That's why I like it. Eons ago, when I was an undergrad, I had a good friend with that same last name." "What college?" "UCSF. My dad went to UCSF for undergrad, too. I graduated in 76. He was a class of 75. His first name is Raymond." I can't believe what she just said. "Ray Strawberry and I always thought of each other as best friends with benefits because his girlfriend was at Harvard and he was madly in love with her and I wasn't really attracted to him at first. Ray and I were both studying our butts off and lonely and needed some relief, so we made a pact. that we would call each other up for sex with no strings attached, which at first we did once a week. But then it got up to twice weekly, and then whenever we could steal a half hour. All was going well until his girlfriend came for spring break, and I realized I was jealous because unbeknownst to me, I had accidentally fallen in love with him. I cannot believe you're his daughter, and these things are sticking. We kind of lost touch after he went off to Yale. Ray was serious about becoming a surgeon, so did he? And is he practicing in the Bay Area? How is he? I'd love to say hello. Wow, what a small world this is. Well, he's passed on. I gently put the ophthalmoscope back on the instrument tray. It doesn't matter that I haven't seen or thought much about Ray in all these years. I can't believe his daughter is sitting in this chair in my office and has just told me that the first man I fell in love with is dead. It's been 5 years now, she says as she brushes her fingers through those thick black tendrils. A 6-car pileup. It was a deer. Shit. I am so sorry to hear this. So very sorry. Shit. I grab a Kleenex for myself and then hand her one. I give her the exam, measure her vision, and dilate her pupils in total silence. She starts to tell me her father's history, but then stops, suddenly, because she knows. When we're finished, I write her a prescription for new contacts, tell her not how nice it was to meet her, that her vision will probably be blurred for the next few hours, and to avoid direct sunlight. On her way out, she hugs me like it's goodbye, and I know she won't be coming back. I'm melancholy for the rest of the day. I don't feel like driving in rush hour traffic and don't feel like going home. I walk 6 blocks toward Fisherman's Wharf. Even though it's only 6 o'clock, it's almost dark and a breeze coming from the bay bites. No matter how warm it is in San Francisco during the day, the temperature is guaranteed to drop as much as 20 degrees by evening, which is why I have on a lined trench coat with a wool scarf wrapped around my neck 4 or 5 times. My hands are in my pockets. I turn left on the Embarcadero and almost bump into a homeless woman blocking the sidewalk. She's wrapped in a grimy green blanket. Her hair is colorless and her face is dirty. I can't tell how old she is, but what I do know is right now, the sidewalk is her home. I open my purse and pull out a bill that happens to be a 20. I put it in her can and keep walking. I do not feel generous. I have no destination in mind, and I'm just trying to register the fact that someone I was once very close to and loved is dead. It doesn't seem to matter that it's been over 30 years since I saw him. It doesn't seem to matter that I can't remember the last time he even entered my mind. What's making me so sad is that he never even knew I loved him. I cross the street and go into the restaurant that's holding happy hour. A handsome host asks if I'm having dinner, and I tell him I don't know. He asks where I'd like to sit, and I point to outside. I follow him, and luckily I'm seated right under a giant heater. Almost all the tables are full of professionals who work nearby. The water in the bay looks black, and the waves are high and heavy. Ferries to Sausalito, Tiburon, and Larkspur are crossing paths out there. They pass right by Alcatraz. The Oakland and Berkeley Hills twinkle on the other side of the bay, and to the left, through light fog, the Golden Gate Bridge still looks red even at night. I take off my coat. Instead of white wine, I order a cappuccino. I should have told Ray I loved him before he graduated. I should have taken the risk of finding out that he didn't love me. But what if he did? When my coffee arrives, I sip the foam and then wipe the rim of the cup with my index finger. As I listen to the waves crashing against the deck below, I'm now wondering where the other men I once loved might be. Whatever happened to them? What are they doing? How did their lives turn out? And are they happy? And are they alive? I've done a pretty good job of airbrushing most of them out of my memory, but now I wonder if they've erased me too. I've been in love at least 5 or 6, maybe even 7 times. 2 I married. 3 were full throttle love, but then the transmission died, and the other 2 were over before we got started. This doesn't include the men I only had sex with. That number is much higher. Over the years, it became clear that sometimes you fall in love only to realize you don't even like the person. Mm-hmm. I liked Ray before I loved him, respected him, and he certainly respected me. He had integrity. He was honest. We talked about anything and everything. He was also a good listener, and I learned to be one, too. I didn't put on airs and didn't have to work to impress him. He liked me as is, which is why we didn't play any silly games. In fact, he was probably the first guy I could say I was friends with. And after he graduated, he went on to Yale and disappeared from my radar. I became a better person because of the time I spent with him, knowing him. I never got a chance to tell him that. But I think I would like to let the other men know what I gained from loving them, maybe even hating them. Right now, I don't exactly know because I've never thought about it before. What I do know is that men have occupied almost 35 years of my entire adult life. That's a whole lot of time. It now seems obvious that the way you're raised has a major impact on what kind of a person you turn out to be, but so does who we love. I want to find them. I want them to know that they were once important to me. I want to tell them what they gave me. I want to find out what I gave them. I want to remember why I loved them, why they loved me. I want to understand why we stopped loving each other, stopped caring for each other. I want to find out why we hurt each other. I want to apologize. I want to explain. I want to forgive them. And I want to find out if they've forgiven me. I want to figure out why it's so hard to forgive. And I want them to know I didn't forget about them, and I just chose now to remember. On the way home, there's no traffic. I feel different, lighter, clearer, as if I've just opened a lane for myself and I'm about to enter it. When we're young, we think we're always going to be young. We thought life was going to be one long party, one thrill after another. We knew we could get over heartache and disappointment and failure in a snap because we were going to have hundreds, if not thousands, of opportunities and do-overs. We knew that success and happiness and love were in the cards. We didn't worry about the future. We were more worried about the next time we were going to get laid. Now, you fall across the bed when you're not sleepy, but just tired of the way you live or aren't living. From the outside, you shouldn't be complaining, but success and a good credit score can't love you or give you an orgasm. You even empty the trash and wonder what you're really throwing away. You comb your hair and put on makeup and buy something pretty to wear and get your nails and toes painted hot pink even though you don't feel hot, and you wonder who will even notice. You shave your legs and under your arms and get your eyebrows waxed, and you wonder who will notice. And then one day, out of nowhere, you stop wondering and start worrying that the best part of your life is behind you. Is this how it's going to be forever? Is this all there is? God, you hope not. On Friday night, I decide not to help Detective Gorin solve any murders. Fuck him. On Saturday, I decide not to go to Costco, Home Depot, Target, or the grocery store because there's really nothing I need. On Sunday morning at 7 o'clock sharp, I text Wanda, my BFF, and meet you at the reservoir. I'll be there at 8. She replies, "We'll meet you there, honey." Wanda happens to be my cheerleader. She's worried that her best friend might die a lonely spinster, which is why she's a nostalgia queen and continues to remind me of when we were hot young things who used to make men take a number. Well, now my number is 175 pounds. She's been happily married to Nelson for 32 years. They chose not to have children and never apologized for it. Three's a crowd, she told me right after they eloped to Maui. Wanda's been my BFF since college, and even though she's opinionated, often misses the mark as well as a point, it's also the reason I love her. I drive up the entrance road lined on both sides with giant oak and pine trees. It feels like an enchanted forest. And when I reach the top where the parking lot is, a huge blue body of water is surrounded by hundreds of acres of green and gold hills. I spot Wanda stretching on a park bench and pull into the parking lot. She's wearing one of her cheap, shiny outfits that she always runs in that she gets from the outlet stores. Before I can figure out how to handle this, Velvet, my other girlfriend, who I wish I could divorce sometimes, but we too have been friends forever, Violet and her daughter, Velvet, jumps out of Violet's right Range Rover, runs over and opens my door and gives me a big hug. "Hi, Auntie. Thought I'd join you guys this morning. It's been too long, I say. with as much enthusiasm as I can muster. She runs over and does the same thing to Wanda. Like mother, like daughter, she's in skin-tight orange leggings and in even tighter white tank top. She has about 1,000 blonde braids that hang down past her shoulders. She runs back to the SUV and hops in. Wanda turns and waves, hunches her shoulders, and I can tell she isn't thrilled to see Violet either. Velvet not only runs her mouth nonstop, but she's loud like her mama. Of course, Violet is on her cell phone and holds up her index finger like she's going to be over to see me in a minute, and I text Wanda, "I'm going to call you in a second. Answer, but don't look up or at me." I dial her number, pretend I'm getting an incoming call. I put a glad to hear from you look on my face. On our walk this morning, I had planned on telling you that I'm seriously thinking about putting my house on the market. I left out something, okay? On the market, and I'm considering selling my share of the practice, and I'm trying to change professions sometime, in the near future, and not necessarily in that order. And Wanda, I just found out that Ray Strawberry died 5 years ago, which has really broken me up. And even though it might sound like a crazy thing to do, I've decided I'm going to look up all the men I've loved just to let them know I'm glad I had the opportunity to know and love them and just to see if they're alive and well. And I know it might be a lot to take in, but now that Wanda, that Violet, and Miss Thang are here, you know we can't talk about nothing real. So I'm hanging up, and we can talk about this another time. I end the call and get out of the car and smile as if I've just received the best news. Wanda and Violet and her daughter, Velvet, decide they're going to go run on the upper hill, okay? They disappear within minutes, which is when Wanda walks over and gives me a hug. "Girl, I am so on your team," she says. And I said, "I know, but let's get warm first. Whenever you're ready, I'm all ears." So we walk for 15 minutes. So I say, "Wait a minute, Georgia. I got to ask you something first, of course. What made you decide to do all this? Sometimes you know in your heart it's time to make a change, but the longer you think about it, the longer the change takes, if ever. I'm finally tired of just thinking about it, but let me ask you a question. Ask away. You're happy with your life, aren't you?" She nods. "Well, I'm not. I'm bored with mine. And since my life is the only thing I do have control over, I want to start changing some of it." "I'm listening. Don't you have any regrets?" "We all have regrets, Georgia." "Well, I feel like I have too many. I'm getting old, Wanda. We're all getting old. Not old, old, but older. And at some point, we need to be honest with ourselves and do what excites us instead of what looks good on paper. I think that's how I ended up in optometry. I was good in science, and I wanted to impress my father by proving how smart I was since he was a doctor. But I just kept on proving it, only to learn out that later he didn't care what I did as long as I loved it. So now here I am not loving it. And even though there's some things I do love to do, I'm not sure if it's too late to find out how I might try to be, how good I might be at them. But so help me God, I'm going to find out. Finally, the Georgia I've missed." "Well, hold on a minute. This isn't I Dream a Genie. One step at a time. First you have to have a dream before you can walk inside of it." "Okay, let's keep walking." And we do. And finally I say, "Let me just say this." She says, let me say this. "Hearing you say you're putting that house on the market is music to my ears." "Why?" "Because you don't need it. You raise your kids. Fuck grass and flowers. Fuck a two-car garage. Get a loft with a whole new view. This way your relatives will stay at a motel when they visit." I don't trust apartment living, Wanda. "Anyway, I just need a new venue. But there won't be a for sale sign in the front yard next week. That much I can tell you." "I know, honey. But this is all just so fucking exciting. And as far as giving up your practice, I say right on. I always thought it was a kind of dull profession with no real payoff, not to mention a little creepy, looking inside folks' eyes all day long. I never really thought it suited you." "Well, why'd you ever say so?" "Because it's right up there with parents trying to tell their kids who not to marry. You have to find out for yourself that you erred. It just takes us a lot longer. Anyway, well, what are you going to do?" "I don't know. The only thing I do..." Let me shut up. So we walk around a curb in silence until something straightens out. So, How'd you find out about Ray again? And then I tell her and all the reasons I've decided to look these men up. As long as you're not trying to be slick and rekindle an old flame that burned out a century ago, I hope. Please, Wanda, you should know me better. I understand that you cannot go back. I'm not sure if I could do this, but hey, this is why people go to shrinks, to get perspective, and that old cliche known as closure. Plus, what do you have to lose? Oh, hell, I see Velvet coming down the path. I would hold off telling this to Violet because she'll probably miss the point. So just tell me real quick, who's up first? I think I should start with Abraham. Well, I would hope so, she says. That's it. Thank you. Oh, yeah. Questions?
Okay, so following on that, the way this works, you raise your hand, we get a mic to you. Who would like to start us off? In the blue hat right behind you, John.
Ms. McMillan, I am a very, very enthusiastic admirer.
You're
a
what?
Enthusiastic admirer of yours, being a self-published author myself. You are the model for which I hope to follow. You single-handedly created what is known as the sister-girlfriend genre, the sister-girlfriend industry, but I understand you are critical of the, have become critical of the so-called sister-girlfriend genre. Could you share that criticism with us?
Well, yeah, it's not true. First of all, you know, I happen to be a black woman, and I write stories that are primarily about black women. And, you know, critics call some of our work as women in general when it deals with other women and our emotions and what we do, and don't even throw love into it. Then they call it chick lit. And it's not chick lit. I don't let anybody define me or my work. And I think that, you know, I mean, I write realistic stories about realistic women and realistic situations. And if they want to refer to that as sister girl, what I, come on. Men write about men. And I think that if your emotional life is off kilter, it affects every other aspect of your life. And so I'm more curious about what happens when we're tilting, or when we're hurting, or suffering, or unhappy, or miserable, or lonely, and you can't pay your bills. That's not just a feminine thing. So I try to excavate and find out what it is that we can do as women to make ourselves feel better if we can't rely on people that are not. Well, no, some women do, too. I'll take that back. I have to change that. This is 2016. Anyway, if you can't rely on your partner, who could be male or female, okay? So, you know, I wish that more men did write on an emotional level because we might understand you suckers better. Does that answer your question?
I'm not here representing the male sex. At least not with regard to Terry. Anybody have another question?
Hello, I'm Sabrina.
Hi,
it's a pleasure to meet you. My question to you is other than being...
Say that again?
I said my question
yes.
to you is, besides being one of the greatest authors that I know, and I'm 42, so you're like on my top five, what do you listen to music-wise? Besides writing, besides...
What do I listen to?
Music-wise, yes. Yes.
Well, I you know, I listen to all kind of music. You know, my publisher asked me to make a playlist for this book, which I did. I have 50 songs on it. And but I wanted to wait at least a week or two before, at least till somebody read, like, the first few paragraphs before you start saying, ooh. You know, do they really? I have really eclectic taste in music. I mean, I'm not real big on rap, even though I like Drake. I mean, I like some rap, but I like R&B. I like Moby. I like all kinds of music. I like classical music. I like piano. I like Spanish music. I listen to all, and if you'll see, if I'm going to put that playlist on. It's on Spotify, but it's going to be on something else. Even if you don't have Spotify, I don't know what that means. But if you can buy $9.99, what do you call those little gift cards, and you can get it for a month. That's all it costs. But it's a slamming playlist. I've got all kinds of people on there with all kinds of music. I'm serious. Never mind. Okay, did that.
Was it music you listened to while writing, or do you not listen to music?
Yeah, it's music
writing.
I listen to already. I mean, I have like about 4,000 songs between iTunes over the years, and I have them all categorized, you know, like my walking music, my I Want to Kill You music, I'm in Love music, Let's Do It Again music, all of that stuff. But I do. I mean, you know, I listen to a lot of chill lounge music from all over the world, and I play music according to my moods or a mood I want to achieve, you know. But I love piano and I love guitar, so I've got some Spanish guitarists and, you know, Sarah Bareilles. Anybody see the Tonys last night? Yeah, Sarah was. But I listen to all kind of music, and I think we all should, but it's good.
Hello.
Hello.
I've been with you since book one. You do a lot of your writing from the state of California's visual kind of context. Are you a California girl or a transplant?
Transplant. No, I'm from Michigan, but north of Detroit. Small town called Port Huron, but I've lived in California in the Bay Area for 25 years. I lived in New York for 15 years, and but I don't usually write about the Bay, and I think the Bay Area and San Francisco in and of itself is beautiful. Yeah, the Bay Area is a little prettier than L.A. San Luis Obispo. Well, yeah. At least you can see it. In Los Angeles. I mean, I live in Pasadena, but it's a little different than Los Angeles. It's out, you know. Yeah. Including the people. But.
Another question.
The question is, who do you read as far as in the fiction and the nonfiction, because I heard that you do coaching for free, relationship coaching.
You heard that I do what?
Do you coach?
Coach who? You did not hear that on a podcast.
I thought I heard that, but I thought I heard something about relationship coaching.
Are you serious? My name is Terry, not Oprah.
Why don't we move on to somebody else? We seem to be striking out here.
But the question is, who do you read as far as
in
nonfiction and fiction as far as what authors? Because I was curious about what are the people that you follow?
What are the what?
Who are the people that
you
follow?
Who do you follow? Who are the writers that you follow in fiction and nonfiction?
Well, first of all,
nonfiction?
Let me just say this, okay? I have a website, and my old website had about 100 writers on it that I really appreciate and respect. And I just got a new website, which I am about to update that component and add on there. Give me about 3 weeks or a month, and then go on there, you will see. It's hard for me to stand here and just name who are my favorite writers, and I was recently asked that question. I read a lot of my contemporaries of all ethnicities, and I read all kinds of books, and I like reading books where the people in them are not like me, because it teaches me respect and empathy, and we realize that, guess what, we are all human. We all suffer from the same stuff. So and I read about all kinds of people. So just do that, okay? I mean, there are some really fine young writers out here, and old ones. But just give me a month or so. But also, you know, if you go on Twitter, if you go on, just Google whatever kind of writers that you're interested in. And right now, there are a lot of, every publication online or whatever, they all have list of, and there's some good books out here right now. There's some good writers out here, and I am not putting myself in there with them.
What's the best book you've read?
Right now, well, I loved Everything I Never Told You. And I'm not going to tell you who it's by. Go look it up.
In the front row here.
Do it. I'm serious.
Hello, my name is Jonathan. I love your tweets. They're very insightful, Lord. And they're funny. Actually, to piggyback off the last question, are you going to create another anthology?
An anthology of other people's work? I don't know for sure. I would love to. There's some really, really good writers. I think there are a lot of really good writers out here. When I did Breaking Ice years ago, it was because I was teaching a class at the University of Wyoming, and I wanted to be able to, you know, display or at least let some of these students know that there were a lot of African-American writers out here. And I couldn't find a body of work that housed a lot of them. And then I realized that there weren't as many of us contemporarily as I thought. And so I came up with this idea for, and I searched for other up-and-coming writers. And I think I would like to do it again, because there are a lot of young writers out here who are good, who have not been yet published, and they deserve the attention. And a lot of them don't know how to go about it. So probably soon, but not next week.
A few more questions.
Hi, my name is Angel. What advice would you give to young aspiring writers?
Wait a minute,
writers?
How old are you?
22.
Oh.
I just graduated from college last month.
I forgot what 22 looks like. What advice would I give to an aspiring writer?
Yes.
Well, first, you mean fiction?
Nonfiction.
Well, I don't know about nonfiction. Well, I could say for now. Well, I'll tell you what I know about writing fiction. You have to get lost. You have to forget about yourself. Write as if no one's ever going to read it. Seriously. And don't go back and edit it. Just keep writing. And don't write to impress anybody. And I would say, I can't say that about nonfiction, but the only thing I can say about writing nonfiction, try Twitter. You can write about what really bothers you, and you can just expand it when you write nonfiction. But I don't know at 22 how much things upset you, not to say that it doesn't, but it's better to write about what pisses you off. Not, you mean you do? That's your mama. Yeah, that makes sense.
Hello, I'm Joanna.
Hi.
I wanted to, thank you for your work over the years and today, but also to get an idea, what is your process? Every writer, like I was reading, Maya Angelou goes into it, well, she used to go in a hotel with, you know, yellow steno pads. Do you need to be by yourself? Do you need to be around other people? Is it just when it hits you? Do you wait for a muse, which you probably don't? Is it in the morning or afternoon? I was just curious, because all your books always seem to be so human. You know what I mean? It seems like, when I say human, I mean you capture the struggle. Yeah, and the acceptance. So I just wanted to get an idea.
Well, I'll put it this way. What I normally do, I mean, first of all, I write. I'm up at every morning at 5 o'clock in the morning. I don't care what happens. People don't call me. They know over the years, don't call me at 7 o'clock unless you had a baby or somebody is gone. But I write early in the morning, and I pray in the morning, every morning. And I forget about Terry McMillan. I do not exist. I'm just a conduit. I usually start a book with a situation, and I'm usually interested. I do a whole thing about, I wanted to say, I'll say like back in the olden days before everything was done online, I used to do what's called like a job application, but it's expanded. I mean, like now it's 6 pages, but I know everything about a character that I'm about to explore. I know what their weaknesses are, their strengths are, their biggest secrets, if they lie, if they cheat, if they pay their bills on time, their favorite class in elementary school, middle school, you know, and what's bothering them right now. I know what size shoe they wear. I know what they hate. I know what they love. I know their biggest form of embarrassment and humiliation. And if they could change anything about their life right now, what would it be? And sometimes that's where I start. Because we all have things that we want to change. And sometimes we don't have the wherewithal, or we do, but we don't know it. And so I climb and fall with them. But the bottom line is I don't write about victims. And if I do, I write about people who have been victimized, which to me is a difference. You know, and you've been victimized, you're going to get up. I'm not going to write about you if you're going to stay down there. You can stay down there by yourself. But we're going to find out, I'm going to find out inside of you what made you fall. And you're going to find out what made you fall. And you're going to figure out how to get back up. Because that's what life to me is about.
Yeah, lady in the black here, about halfway back.
First of all, easier said than done.
Your dress is amazing. That's
the dress?
Number one.
Oh,
that's amazing, amazing.
This is from Nigeria.
I thought so.
You know Zuba?
No, but I want your dress. But it looks so beautiful. But the
Thank
other
you.
Thing I wanted to say, I didn't plan on speaking, but when I was in school in D.C., I picked up Disappearing Acts. Like 3 in the afternoon, the only book in my life, I stayed up till 9 o'clock the next morning and finished it. The Ooh. Only book in my whole life I did that. So I just wanted to say thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you all for coming.
Hello, Miss McMillan. Hi. I am a self-proclaimed boomerologist.
A what?
Self-proclaimed boomerologist.
Boomerologist?
That's it. One who studies baby boomers, people born between 1946 and 64.
Okay.
Of which I believe you are. Yes? Somewhere in there.
You better
okay,
ask it
fast. Okay, what's your question?
My question, Ms. McMillan, is... As a baby boomer, do you have any suggestions for somebody who is midlife who might? Wait a minute. I'm talking about boomers.
Who might what?
Who is midlife?
I heard you.
Yeah. and I said who might want to begin writing at this
begin
point?
Begin writing?
Yes.
Start. I'm serious. There's no panacea. There's no magic to it. And it doesn't matter how old you are, you know? And you don't write, just like I was telling this young lady, you don't write to impress. Nobody really cares sometimes what you think. And they don't really care what you know. Except, and if so, you write nonfiction. If you're trying to explain something, what you write about when you're trying to write fiction, and it doesn't matter, what's up with the baby boomer business?
You know,
but the bottom line is this, there's a lot of dumb baby boomers too. Okay? And unfortunately there are a lot of older people who think they know everything and they don't. You know? And you don't write because you think of what you think you know. You write to understand, because there's a certain, we got a Donald Trump out here as it is who thinks he knows everything, okay? So you write in an effort to understand and to get some clarity. And you don't start from this position about you think you already got it figured out. That's a mistake right there. So, Ms. Boomer, be humble. Thank you,
Wisdom
everybody.
From Terry McMillan.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.